Good morning, everyone. Happy Tuesday. I'm Steve. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm going to be reading the Arizona Daily Star today for Tuesday, the 13th of May, 2025. Hope that everybody will have a good day today. Let's see. Before we go to the Star, I thought we would go ahead and check the weather. I think the word of the weather is wind. So let's go ahead and check that out here. The National Weather Service has this synopsis for us today. Yeah, it's a red flag warning all through the Tucson region and generally southeast Arizona. And the synopsis reads as follows. High temperatures for the next week will generally be below normal for mid-May. A storm system moving to our north across the Great Basin will result in breezy to windy southwest to west winds today through Wednesday. Less wind is coming our way on Thursday and Friday, and then we're going to return to breezy conditions over the upcoming weekend. So hold on to your hats, everybody, and please be fire safe. All right, that's it. So we're going to go ahead and move on to the Arizona Daily Star. And thanks so much to the Star for donating this subscription. Here are the front page story titles. Less farmland is going for organic. The U.S. and China are reaching a deal to slash tariffs for now. Governor Katie Hobbs won't disclose money she's taking for legal fees. And finally, the fourth of four front page stories this morning. Trump defends Qatari jet offer. Let's go ahead to that first front page story this morning. This is Skaneateles, New York. Yeah, interesting name for a place. Farmer Jeremy Brown taps the nose of a young calf. He says, "I love the ones with the pink noses." The pink-nosed animal is just one of about 3,200 cattle at Twin Birch Dairy in Skaneateles, New York. In Brown's eyes, the cows on the farm aren't just workers. They're the boss, he says. They're the queen of the barn. Brown, who's a co-owner of Twin Birch, is outspoken on the importance of sustainability in his operation. The average dairy cow emits as much as 265 pounds of methane, a potent climate warming gas, each year. Brown says Twin Birch has worked hard to cut its planet warming emissions through a number of environmentally sound choices. Ruminants are the solution, not the problem, to climate change, he claims. Wearing a weathered hoodie and a hat promoting a brand of cow medicine, Brown was spending a windy Friday morning artificially inseminating some of the farm's massive Jerseys and Holsteins. He stepped over an electric manure scraper used to clean the animal's barn. The electric scraper means the dairy doesn't have to use a fuel-burning mechanism for that particular job. Twin Birch also recycles manure for use on crops, cools its milk with water that gets recirculated for cows to drink, and grows most of its own food. Despite all of that, the farm has no desire to pursue a U.S. Department of Agriculture organic certification, Brown said. Doing so would add costs and require the farm to forego technology that makes the dairy business and ultimately the customer's jug of milk more affordable, he said. He raises a question many farmers have been asking. Specifically, is organic farming just a word? An increasing number of American farmers think so. America's certified organic acreage fell almost 11% between 2019 and 2021. Numerous farmers who implement Sustainable Practices told the Associated Press that they have stayed away from the certification because it's costly, doesn't go enough, and doesn't do enough to combat climate change, and appears to be losing cachet in the marketplace. Converting an existing farm to conventional to organic, that's converting an existing farm from conventional to organic agriculture, can cost tens of thousands of dollars and add labor costs. The rules governing the National Organic Program were published in 2000, and in the years after, organic farming boomed to eventually reach more than 5 million acres, but that has declined in recent years. Any downward trend is significant, as organic farms make up less than 1% of the country's total acreage, and organic sales are typically only a tiny share of the nationwide total. Shannon Ratcliffe, a farmer and cow owner of organically certified Shannon Brook Farms in Watkins Glen, New York, attributes the decline to a 2018 fraud case in Iowa involving a farmer selling grain mislabeled as certified organic. The whole thing went crazy, she said. Work requirements for farmers ramped up and inspection levels were higher. It's also just a tough business, she said. Her co-owner, Walter Adam, also thinks younger generations' interest in farming of any kind is also declining. It takes 6 months to learn everything, Adam said. We can't find anybody as willing to work on the farm. And Adam drives to Manhattan each week to sell their meat and eggs at markets and spends Sunday mornings helping Ratcliffe with business at the Brighton Farms Market in Brighton, New York. Frank Mitlohoner, sorry, that's Frank Mitlohoner, a professor in animal science at the College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences at the University of California, Davis, said lack of flexibility and efficiency are driving farmers away from organic in an era of rising prices for farmers. He said organic standards need to be overhauled, or the marketplace risks organic going away completely. So that story is titled, Less Farmland is Going Organic. Let's go to our next front page story this morning. The U.S. and China have reached a deal to slash tariffs for now. The United States and China agreed Monday to slash their massive recent tariffs, restarting stalled trade between the world's two biggest economies and setting off a rally in global financial markets. But the de-escalation in President Donald Trump's trade wars did nothing to resolve the underlying differences between Beijing and Washington. The deal lasts 90 days, creating time for the U.S. and Chinese negotiators to reach a more substantive agreement. But the pause also leaves tariffs higher than before Trump started ramping them up last month. Businesses and investors must contend with uncertainty about whether the truce will last. U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer said the U.S. agreed to drop the 145% tax Trump imposed last month to 30%. That's 30%. China agreed to lower its tariff rate on the U.S. goods from 125% to 10%. Greer and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced the tariff reductions at a news conference in Geneva. The official said the two sides set up consultations to continue discussing their trade issues. Bessent said the triple-digit tariffs the two countries imposed on each other last month, in an escalation of tensions Trump started, amounted to the equivalent of an embargo, and neither side wants that. We do want trade, he said. The delegations met for at least a dozen hours on both days of the weekend at a sun-baked 18th century villa that serves as the official residence of the Swiss ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva. So, the 30% levy that America is now imposing on Chinese goods includes an existing 20% tariff intended to pressure China into doing more to prevent the synthetic opioid fentanyl from entering the United States. It also includes the same 10% baseline tariff Trump slapped on imports from most of the world's countries. The 30% tax comes on top of other levies on China, including some left over from Trump's first term and kept by former President Joe Biden. Trump ratcheted the combined tariff to 145% last month, furious that China retaliated before backing down on Monday. China's Commerce Ministry called the agreement an important step for the resolution of the two countries' differences and said it lays the foundation for further cooperation. This initiative aligns with the expectations of producers and consumers in both countries and serves the interests of both nations as well as the common interests of the world, a ministry statement said. China hopes the U.S. will stop, quote, the erroneous practice of unilateral tariff hikes and work with China to safeguard the development of economic and trade relations, injecting more certainty and stability into the economy, unquote, said the Chinese ministry. The joint statement by the two countries said China also agreed to suspend or remove other measures it took since April 2nd in response to the U.S. tariffs. China increased export controls on rare earths, including some critical to the defense industry, and added more American companies to its export control and unreliable entity lists, restricting their business with and in China. So, folks, that's a bit of an update. The U.S. and China reach a deal to slash tariffs for now. Let's go ahead and move on to the next front page story. And if you're just joining us, welcome in. I'm Steve, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading the Arizona Daily Star for today, the 13th of May, 2025. This next story is about Katie Hobbs. She's not going to disclose money she's taking for legal fees. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs is getting money from special interests and other donors and not disclosing who they are. And it's perfectly legal because of an exception carved into state law nearly a decade ago. Hobbs has set up a special fund to pay for the costs of her campaign incurred in defending her against lawsuits filed by failed Republican gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, challenging the legitimacy of Hobbs' 2022 election. But Hobbs never publicly disclosed the existence of the special account. Instead, she is relying on the law that creates the exception allowing candidates to approach donors and take as much as they want for legal fees from anyone without having to file the same reports required of other campaign expenses. Her fund would have remained secret except that one donor, Pinnacle West Capital Corporation, the parent company of Arizona Public Service, the state's largest electric utility, filed a new report disclosing that it gave the governor $100,000 last year for her legal expenses. The report, obtained by Capital Media Services, shows that's more money than Pinnacle West Capital gave anyone in political donations in 2024. The only reason the company provided the information is that the Arizona Corporation Commission, which regulates APS, that's the Arizona Public Service Utility, APS, ordered regulated utilities to file such reports after they were accused a decade ago of secretly funneling money into efforts to elect commission members of their choosing, a spokesman for the Hobbs campaign, Michael Beyer, that's B-E-Y-E-R, Michael Beyer, refused Monday to disclose others who have given to her special fund, nor would he say the total amount the governor has collected for her legal fees. Instead, Beyer said the fund's creation was justified. Carrie Lake baselessly challenged the results of a free and fair election she lost, Beyer said. We won 8 times in court, and yet Lake fought the results all the way through November 2024 when she finally lost her last appeal to the Arizona Supreme Court. This isn't the first time Pinnacle West has donated corporate funds for Hobbs' benefit. The company in 2023 gave $250,000 to the governor's inaugural fund, money that also was not publicly disclosed until reported by Capital Media Services. That was part of more than $1.9 million Hobbs took in for the 2023 event in January, an event that cost only $207,000 to put on. The balance went into campaign accounts for the governor's 2026 re-election efforts. Required campaign finance reports show she has about $4.1 million in the bank. The new Pinnacle West report also shows the company gave another $50,000 this past year to the Democratic Governors Association, which in turn is free to spend the money to help Hobbs remain in office. Hobbs won't disclose money she's taking for the legal fees that she incurred as a result of having to defend her election against Carrie Lake's protests. Let's go to the last front page story. It's about Trump and that jet. Trump defends Qatari jet offer for President Donald Trump, accepting a free Air Force One replacement from Qatar, that's Q-A-T-A-R, Qatar, is a no-brainer. He said, quote, I would never be one to turn down that kind of offer. I could be a stupid person and say, no, we won't want a free, very expensive airplane, unquote. Critics of the plan worry that the move threatens to turn a global symbol of American power into an airborne collection of ethical, legal, security, and counterintelligence concerns. This is unprecedented, said Jessica Levinson, who is a constitutional law expert at Loyola Law School. We just haven't tested these boundaries before. Trump tried to tamp down some of the opposition by saying he won't fly around in the gifted Boeing 747 when his term ends. Instead, he said, the $400 million plane would be donated to a future presidential library, similar to how the Boeing 707 used by President Ronald Reagan was decommissioned and put on display as a museum piece. Quote, it would go directly to the library after I leave office, unquote, Trump said. I wouldn't be using it, he said. However, that did little to quell the controversy over the plane. Democrats are united in outrage, and even some of the Republican president's allies are worried. Laura Loomer, an outspoken conspiracy theorist who has tried to purge disloyal officials from the administration, wrote on social media that she would take a bullet for Trump, quote-unquote, but said she's, quote, so disappointed, unquote. Trump will likely face persistent questions about the plane in the coming days as he travels to the Middle East, including a stop in Qatar. The two planes, currently used as Air Force One, have been flying for nearly 4 decades, and Trump is eager to replace them. During his first term, he displayed a model of a new jumbo jet in the Oval Office, complete with a revised paint scheme that echoed the red, white, and dark blue design of his personal plane. Boeing has been working on retrofitting 747s that were originally built for a now-defunct Russian airliner. But the program has faced nearly a decade of delays, with perhaps more on the way from a series of issues, including a critical subcontractor's bankruptcy and the difficulty of finding and retaining qualified staff who could be awarded high-level security clearances. The new planes aren't due to be finished until near the end of Trump's term, and he's out of patience. He has described the situation as, quote, a total mess, unquote, and he has complained that Air Force One isn't as nice as the planes flown by some Arab leaders. It's not even the same ball game, he said. Trump said Qatar, who hosts the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East, offered a replacement plane that could be used while the government was waiting for the Boeing to finish. We give free things out, he said. We'll take one, too, said Trump. He bristled at suggestions that he should turn down the plane, comparing the potential gift to favors on the golf course. When they give you a putt, you pick it up and you walk to the next hole and say, thank you very much, he said. Senate Majority Leader John Thune of Dakota, that's South Dakota, expressed skepticism. I understand his frustration. They're way behind schedule on delivering the next Air Force One, the Republican told reporters. Whether or not this is the right solution or not, I don't know. So, will the plane be secure? The Qatari plane has been described as a, quote, palace in the sky, complete with luxurious accommodations and top-of-the-line finishes. But security is the primary concern when it comes to presidential travel. The current Air Force One planes were built from scratch near the end of the Cold War. They are hardened against the effects of a nuclear blast and include a range of security features such as anti-missile countermeasures and an onboard operating room. They are also equipped with air-to-air refueling capabilities for contingencies, though it has never been utilized with a president on board. A former U.S. official briefed on the Air Force One replacement project said that while it would be possible to add some features to the Qatari jet, there was no way to add the full suite of capabilities to the plane on a tight timetable. So there you have it. Trump defends Qatari jet offer, and those are the front page stories for this morning. They were by title, Less Farmland is Going for Organic, The U.S. and China Reach a Deal to Slash Tariffs for Now, Hobbs Won't Disclose Money She's Taking for Legal Fees, and then finally, the fourth of four, Trump Defends Qatari Jet Offer. Let's move on to the local news in the Tucson and Region section of The Star. Welcome in. I'm Steve, a volunteer reader. I'm reading The Star for today, the 13th of May, 2025. Here are the local stories this morning. Well, the first big one involves wind and generally fire weather. Fire restrictions are launched in southern Arizona, citing heat and dry conditions, which we've all felt. State and federal agencies across southern Arizona have implemented fire restrictions, authorities say. The restrictions started Monday and affect public land in the region. Among areas included are the following: Coronado National Forest, Saguaro National Park, Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, and Tumacacori National Historic Park. The following activities are prohibited, specifically building, maintaining, attending, or using a fire, campfire, charcoal, coal, elevated grill, or wood stove. This includes fires in developed campgrounds or improved sites. Smoking, except within an enclosed vehicle or building. Discharging a firearm, including target shooting, except while engaged in lawful hunt pursuant to state, federal, or tribal laws and regulations. Also prohibited, operating any internal combustion engine off designated roadways, welding, and use of explosives. Violation of these restrictions is punishable by a fine, imprisonment, or both. Violators also could be held personally responsible for reimbursement of firefighting costs. Residents and visitors should check with the respective county and tribal governments for information on the implementation of fire bans across unincorporated county lands as well as within tribal jurisdictions. Fire conditions as well as localized closures and restrictions are subject to change. For a more detailed explanation concerning agency restrictions and fire information, please contact the nearest land management agency office. Go to the following web address, https://wildlandfire.arizona.gov. And that gives us information on fire restrictions. For more information on that, go to the website again. I'll repeat, https://wildlandfire. That's all connected, wildlandfire.az.gov. There you have it. The restrictions started Monday and affect public lands in the region. And I've already given you the lands that are affected by that set of restrictions. So please be careful out there. It's going to be very windy, very hot, and the fire danger is going to be very high. Let's move on to Senator Gallego pushing an immigration plan. Let's see. Democratic Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego is wading into one of Washington's most contentious and intractable political problems as he puts forward a plan Monday aimed at reforming the country's immigration system and beefing up border security. The plan by Gallego, who beat Republican Carrie Lake in last fall's tight Senate race, calls for hiring more Border Patrol agents, using technology to stop fentanyl smuggling, reforming the asylum system, adding more ways for people to come to the U.S., and a pathway to citizenship for some immigrants. Gallego's plan comes 3 months into President Donald Trump's administration as Trump seeks to deliver on campaign promises of carrying out mass deportations. His plan, or any other from Democrats, is unlikely. That's when we say his plan, that's Gallego's plan. Gallego's plan, or any other from Democrats, is unlikely to get much traction with Trump in the White House. But it illustrates that the debate about legislative solution carries on. Many members of Congress have tried and failed to change the immigration system. A small group of senators led by Gallego's predecessor, Kyrsten Sinema, negotiated for months in 2023 and 2024 over a border bill that would have toughened asylum protocols for migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, hired more officers to evaluate asylum claims and Border Patrol agents, and given money to local governments seeking influxes of migrants. That effort ran into a wall of opposition just hours after the bill was released. The last time Congress even came close to a breakthrough on immigration reform was in 2013, when a bipartisan group of senators pushed forward legislation creating a pathway to citizenship for millions of people in the country illegally and expanding work visas while tightening border security and mandating that employers verify workers' legal status. The Senate approved that proposal, but it was rejected by the House. Gallego's plan includes some elements that likely will find bipartisan support, such as his calls to beef up border security. But other parts, like efforts to legalize anyone already in the country illegally, will prove much more contentious. We don't have to choose between border security and immigration reform. We can show and we can do both, said Giego. Let's go to Biggs. This is Andy Biggs's push for Medicaid cuts. It could become a political headache. Representative Andy Biggs is pushing for cuts to Medicaid that could kick tens of thousands of Arizonans off their health insurance and create a state budget headache he'd need to manage if elected governor. The proposal, which a GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson recently put on ice, is part of a Republican effort to cut government spending and fund an extension of President Donald Trump's 2017 tax cut. The Trump administration also is seeking to rein in federal spending on a broader scale through the Department of Government Efficiency, that's DOGE. DOGE says it wants to cut $1 trillion in federal spending this year. But downsizing federal Medicaid spending could be a dilemma for state budget writers and a political landmine for statewide candidates. Those candidates will include Biggs, Republican from Arizona, if he wins the Republican primary for governor against Karen Taylor Robson next year. Both GOP candidates are endorsed by Trump. His number one goal is to win a Republican primary, and then his number one goal after that will be to win a general election, said Chuck Coughlin, a Phoenix political consultant who advised former Governor Jan Brewer when she expanded Medicaid in Arizona. Those policy ideas are in conflict with one another, particularly in the general election. Lawmakers on the committee that oversees Medicaid are under pressure to trim $880 billion in spending over the next 9 years to help fund the tax cut extension. Biggs, a vocal Trump ally, defended the proposal to trim Medicaid expansion funding on the House floor. He said, "The original Medicaid program was designed to help the disabled, pregnant women, seniors, children. Then there was this expansion that came along, and it's filled with able-bodied adults of working age who could be working. That is the fastest-growing program in the United States today, and they pay out about $100 billion a year in, frankly, lost payments," Biggs said in a speech, which he later shared on social media. "Republicans want to deal with that," he said. However, others on the far right, such as longtime Trump ally Steve Bannon and Laura Loomer, the Arizona-born activist who has Trump's ear, have warned against cutting Medicaid. Biggs, who was the state Senate president when Arizona implemented Medicaid expansion, argued that too many adults are on Medicaid who don't need to be. The result is federal money spent that the government could be saving, Biggs said. Bannon disagrees. Quote, "We can't go in with a meat axe and cut Medicaid. There's a ton of MAGA, of working class folks, Hispanic, Black, whites, that are all on Medicaid, that are working, not sitting there gaming the system. Not asking for a handout. Why? Because the jobs don't pay enough," Bannon said on a recent episode of his War Room podcast. The Republican House Speaker, Biggs, has also backed off the idea after the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Oh, that's actually, in this case, Mike Johnson. The Republican House Speaker, Mike Johnson, has also backed off the idea after the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office found that cutting funds to Medicaid expansion could save $710 billion, but cause 5.5 million people to lose coverage nationwide. So there you have it, folks. That's the information about Biggs's push for Medicaid cuts, and it could become a big political headache. So those are the local news stories this morning in the Star. Fire restrictions. Oh, here we go again. Sorry, folks, just a bit of a pause. I seem to be getting this request from the star to update a password, which I don't have to update. Okay, so back to Tucson and region. Fire restrictions launched across southern Arizona. Senator Gallego pushes immigration plan, and then finally, Biggs' push for Medicaid cuts could become a political headache. Now we can go on to the business section of the Star. States expect slowdown in apartment construction. Well, before we do that, let's go ahead and take a look at the markets, because you folks, some of you are interested in the market, and I'm just looking at the markets now, and the percent change is all positive, except for the Dow Utilities. They were down about 1.7%, but everything else was up. So the market seems to be up, at least for now. Here's the story in the business section. States expect slowdown in apartment construction. More new apartments were built in 2024 than in any other year since 1974. But the Trump administration's tariffs and deportations of potential construction workers, plus higher interest rates, could be a wet blanket on the boom. A U.S. Census Bureau survey found almost 592,000 new apartments were finished last year, the most since the 1970s, when baby boomers sparked a construction surge as they moved out of their neighborhood and childhood homes. There were 693,000 new apartments built in 1974, when the country had about half as many households. But there has been a steep slowdown in construction starts as the newly completed apartments come online. The increased supply has lowered rents and increased vacancy rates, making new development less profitable. Some experts also say tariffs on construction materials and labor shortages caused by dips in immigration will create headwinds for new construction. Apartment starts were down 27% in 2024 compared with 2023, and down 37% from a recent peak of 531,000 in 2022, despite the historic rate of completions. Apartment starts were at their lowest ebb since 2013. Housing experts have long lamented that there aren't enough apartments and single-family houses in the U.S., at least not in the places where people want to live and at the prices they can afford. Estimates of the national housing shortage last year varied widely from 15 million houses and apartments to 20.1 million houses and apartments. Since then, another 1.6 million houses and apartments have been built. Most experts estimate a shortage of 1.5 million to 5.5 million houses and apartments, according to the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University. Some states are building apartments faster than others, according to a statewide and a state line analysis. Though completions aren't tracked by state, permits that lead to new apartments have been granted at high rates in recent years in South Dakota, Utah, Arizona, and Colorado. Rates are lowest in Mississippi, Wyoming, West Virginia, Rhode Island, Oklahoma, and Alaska. The massive jump in apartment construction has its roots in 2021 and 2022, when interest rates were low and rent growth was high, said Rob Warnock, who's a senior researcher associate for Apartment List, that's capital A, capital L, Apartment List, a company that posts rental listings online. So that's a bit of information on the states expecting a slowdown in apartment construction. And that was the only business article this morning in the business section of the Arizona Daily Star. So now we go on to the opinion section, and if you're just joining us, I am Steve. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm reading the Arizona Daily Star for today, the 13th of May, 2025. And as we turn to the opinion section of the Star, I want to remind our readers that the opinions that I'm about to read are those of the writers of the articles. The first one, water rake height for catty is unfair. And this opinion piece is written by Josh Jacobson. Josh Jacobson is a small business owner and an advocate for the future of Tucson. Here's the article. It's the opinion piece by Josh Jacobson. Water rate hike for county is unfair. As a small business owner operating on a county island just outside Tucson city limits, I, like many others in unincorporated Pima County, depend on the city of Tucson for water and the county for sewer. This decades-old regional arrangement has long worked until now. The city is using its control over water to push an agenda that is not only unfair, but deeply political. This is not the first time the city of Tucson has tried to impose differential water rates on unincorporated residents. A judge already ruled against the city in a prior legal challenge. This time, the approach is even more calculated. The city has exempted the county itself as a ratepayer, intentionally removing, quote, standing, unquote, for the county to sue again. And despite the court's earlier decision, county residents were never reimbursed for the overcharges. Tucson Water's new differential rate structure raises costs by 16% to 23%, exclusively for unincorporated residents and businesses. We don't have a vote in city government. We have no representation on the Tucson City Council. Yet, we are being asked to pay significantly more for the exact same service. This isn't a routine cost observance adjustment. This isn't a routine cost of service adjustment. It's a targeted increase, a tax without representation. In the May 6th Board of Supervisors meeting, Supervisor Steve Christie said it plainly, quote, if you don't like high water rates, there's a cure for that. Allow the city of Tucson to annex you, unquote. He called the tactic what it is, blackmail. That same day, the Pima County Board of Supervisors debated Resolution 2025-10. That's 2025-10, which would have formally opposed these differential rates and directed county staff to support legal challenges brought by residents or associations. Supervisor Rex Scott, who sponsored the resolution, called the city's plan inherently discriminatory and unfair, quote unquote. Scott explained that nearly one-third of Tucson Water's customers live in the unincorporated county. They began with an end in mind, jacking up rates solely on customers in the unincorporated county. He and Christie were the only two supervisors to vote in favor. The resolution failed in a 2-3 vote. Supervisors Andres Cano, Jennifer Allen, and Matt Hines voted against it, even though all three represent unincorporated areas. In fact, Allen openly acknowledged, quote, nearly 60% of my constituents live in unincorporated areas, unquote, yet still oppose the measure, calling its tone confrontational, she said. Supervisor Cano defended the city's actions, stating, quote, Tucson Water is organized as an enterprise. Water efficiency programs are not only smart, they're economical, unquote. But those words ring hollow to businesses and families now paying more simply because they're not inside city limits. Supervisor Matt Hines declined to take any stand at all. I don't support legal action, but I support dialogue, he said. Are we even paying enough for water in the desert? He asked. These are not serious responses to a serious problem. These are elected officials deflecting from their responsibility to defend the people they serve. Meanwhile, Pima County is not growing. The region has... Oh, I got an interrupt from the Arizona Daily Star again. One moment, please, ladies and gentlemen. My apologies. I have to get back to the Star's opinion piece. And here it is, back to the water rate hike. Meanwhile, Pima County is not growing. The region has seen stagnant population numbers for years, yet instead of pursuing real economic development, the same supervisors who refused to stand up to the city are advancing policies under their Pima Prosperous Plan. That's capital P, Pima Prosperous Plan, that will almost certainly lead to higher taxes on county residents. With talk of property tax increases already circulating, these water rate hikes are just the beginning. Differential rates will leave thousands of families and businesses with higher bills and no recourse. This is not just flawed policy. It is a failure of representation. The Board of Supervisors was not created to act as an extension of the City Council. Supervisors Scott and Christie deserve credit for standing their ground and defending their constituents. They stood for fairness and transparency. The rest chose loyalty to City Hall over the people who elected them. Water is not a political weapon, but in Tucson, it is being used as one. A tax on county residents that advances the City of Tucson's agenda. As the old saying goes, quote, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting, unquote. That appears to be the law of the land in the old Pueblo once again. And that opinion piece was written to us this morning from Josh Jacobson. He's a small business owner and advocate for the future of Tucson. And the title of this opinion piece was Water Rate Hike for County Unfair. Let's go to our next opinion piece this morning. It's about Rio Nuevo. And Rio Nuevo, the writer says, should listen to the community's concerns. And our writer is Kristen Tovar. Kristen Tovar is a Tucson resident, mother, and owner of Why I Love Where I Live. That's Why I Love Where I Live, with two retail locations in Arizona. So this is her opinion piece. Why Rio Nuevo should listen to community's concerns. Rio Nuevo would be wise to consider the community's strong reaction to its recent decision to allocate $2.1 million in support of a Live Nation-backed comedy club. The backlash is more than a flicker on the dashboard. It is a check engine light. Sure, you can keep driving for a while with that light on, but keep ignoring the warning signs and you may end up with a bill that's impossible to pay. To understand authentic revitalization, we might look to someone like Jane Jacobs, whose birthday was just celebrated on May 4th. She once said, "Cities have the capability of providing something for everybody, only because, and only when, they are created by everybody." Her vision was one of cities built with the people, not just for them. So, what could a truly revitalized downtown Tucson look like? It would be a place where people of all ages and backgrounds find belonging and purpose, where creativity, connection, collaboration, and shared ownership are the foundation from which all other elements flow. Take Playformance as a prime example. That's capital P, Playformance. This children's activity center is more than just a space for play. It's a place where young people learn to manage conflict, collaborate, and work toward shared goals, even amid disagreement. That's exactly the kind of human development we need more of in Tucson. Imagine if our city's leaders modeled the same values, specifically empathy, curiosity, and cooperation, even when challenged, especially when challenged. It's time to reimagine, says Kristen Tovar, what revitalization can be. It must be rooted in transparency, open-hearted leadership, and genuine collaboration. When residents and local business owners raise concerns about fairness in development and real estate practices, we should be listening. Why would we ignore those who have firsthand experience and stories to share? Discernment with sales tax dollars should come with accountability. If we want good stories to come out of Tucson, we should be open to feedback on how to shape the future of our city. The bridges we need can only be built together, and yes, they should include families and children who live here, not just U of A students we hope to woo. If Rio Nuevo is serious about revitalizing downtown, it needs to be in touch with the local entrepreneurs and everyday citizens who have poured their time, money, and livelihood into creating the culture and community that make Tucson special. Personally, she says, I want to see Tucson and its downtown thrive. We all do, but we risk everything when we reduce complex challenges to simple binary arguments. The frustration people feel about importing success from outside is a recognition that we already have the ingredients here. We already have the talent, and apparently we even have the funding. History has shown that what happens when we ignore community voices for the sake of urban renewal and revitalization causes failure. The wise won't repeat those mistakes. So here's my appeal to decision makers and those in positions of power. Listen deeply, engage humbly, and make room at the table. Let's build a downtown and a city that people can truly rejoice in. And that opinion piece was written this morning by Kristen Tovar. She is a Tucson resident, mother, and owner of Why I Love Where I Live, with two retail locations in Arizona. Let's go to our last opinion piece this morning. And it is, immigration data bill would harm health initiatives. So this opinion piece is written by a group of folks who are students at the public health, their master's of public health at the University of Arizona. McKaylee White, Anas Al-Husseini, Jessica Francis, and Stephanie Hernandez, and Cheryl Valdez. They're all Masters of Public Health students at the UA with the Mel and Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health. Let's see what they have to say to us this morning about immigration data bill would harm health initiatives. With respect to the article titled, quote, Arizona legislature require hospitals to ask if patients were here legally, unquote, published on May 6th of this year, grave concerns emerge regarding the impact of Senate Bill 1268, that's 1268. Although framed as a data collection initiative to track uncompensated care, requiring hospitals to inquire about a patient's immigration status could discourage individuals from seeking necessary medical care. This approach endangers vulnerable populations and undermines public health and trust in the healthcare system. Public health works as intended when systems address the root cause of illness, such as barriers to access, rather than worsening them. Initiatives like vaccination campaigns, prenatal care programs, and chronic disease management not only reduce long-term healthcare costs, but also support individuals through early preventative care. Strong public health data helps agencies detect and respond to emergency threats, that's emerging threats, while community-based partnerships that bring together local organizations, health departments, and residents lead to more effective and culturally relevant interventions. Open data initiatives, such as the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, have enhanced research, strengthened emergency preparedness, and promoted transparency. When these efforts focus on the connections between social issues and health within communities. They build trust, empower residents, and ensure the health improvements are both sustainable and equitable. However, policies that undermine trust in healthcare care, such as requiring hospitals to track patients' legal status, threaten to reverse these public health gains and create new barriers for vulnerable communities. The purpose of this bill, that's Bill 1268, is posed as identifying how much of a state-funded hospital's uncompensated care is from treating undocumented immigrants who do not pay. However, this bill does not help with actually addressing uncompensated care. Looking deeper, you will find that it is patients without insurance who are the least likely to be able to pay for their care. This is not only due to being undocumented. Many Americans cannot afford health insurance, even when they work at a company that covers some of their monthly insurance premium. Senate Bill 1268 is not a solution. It's a distraction. It trades compassion for fear and undermines public health in the process. We urge Arizona lawmakers to reject policies that weaponize healthcare access and instead pursue meaningful reforms that strengthen our health system for all. Every person, regardless of immigration status, deserves to seek care without fear of discrimination, detention, or deportation. Our health is a community. Our health as a community depends on it. And that opinion piece this morning, which closes out our program, folks, is by Mikhaili White, Anas Al-Husseini, Jessica Francis, Stephanie Hernandez, and Cheryl Valdez. And they are Masters of Public Health students with the UA Mill and Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health. That does it for today, folks. Stay well. Be careful out there. It's going to be windy. Hold on to your hats. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time for listening this morning. I wish you the best of goodbyes.